Welcome to Reboot with Dr. R.C. Marin, where we explore all kinds of difficult topics and approaches to healing and wellness in different aspects of your life. I'm your host, Dr. R.C. Marin, and today we have an absolutely fascinating guest who brings both professional expertise and personal experience to our discussion about chronic pain and fibromyalgia. I have with me today Dr. Martina Ziegenben, who is a board-certified rheumatologist with over 17 years of clinical experience. But what makes her approach truly unique is that she's also her patient herself, living with both fibromyalgia and rheumatoid arthritis. She is the founder of the Whole Health Rheumatology of Cape Cod and hosts her own podcast, Winning at Fibromyalgia. Dr. Z's journey began when she was just 17 years old, watching her uncle battle kidney cancer, which led to a career in medicine. She moved from Slovakia to the United States, completed a medical training at several of the prestigious institutions such as Boston University Medical Center, Johns Hopkins. Today, she is revolutionizing how we think about chronic pain, particularly fibromyalgia, by combining cutting-edge neuroscience with a compassionate, holistic human approach. She believes understanding the brain's role in chronic pain is extremely important and can unlock new pathways to healing. Dr. Z, welcome to Reboot, and I'm so glad you could make it today.
Thank you so much for the lovely introduction. You definitely did your homework. I was very impressed that you were able to find all the information about me. Thank you so much. And I'm honored to be here.
So, you know, let's deep dive. You know, pain is such a sensitive topic and it's a very subjective topic. We all know the 1 to 10 pain scale, but somebody else's 8 out of 10 could be my 2 out of 10, and my 2 out of 10 could be somebody's 15 out of 10. You know, it's a very subjective situation. But I have heard you say, mentioned in several of your writings, that pain is not in your head, but it is in your brain. Can you unpack that distinction?
Thank you very much for the question. And you are right, pain is a very subjective experience. And specifically, we are talking about chronic pain because I will use this opportunity to explain the difference between chronic pain and regular pain. Regular pain is what we experience when we are injured or when we pour hot coffee on our arm. It's adaptive and it's meant to lead us away from danger. That's how nervous system evolved. Chronic pain, on the other hand, is maladaptive. It does not serve the purpose of warning us about danger. It's just there sometimes for no reason at all. And the reason that it's relevant to say that the pain is in your brain, that it's not in your head, is because many patients, especially women with chronic pain and especially with fibromyalgia, have been told in the past for years and years and years that there is nothing wrong with them. Hence, ergo, it means the pain is somehow imagined or it's in their head. And that was very detrimental to women and patients in general, but women are more often diagnosed with fibromyalgia than men. And that led to a lot of research, obviously. And that research has shown us once and for all that when a person with chronic pain tells us they experience pain, we know the pain is real. But we also know that there is no damage. And that's why we say the pain is coming from your brain or from your central nervous system. It's definitely not imagined. It's real. And the way we found out, I mentioned we as the neuroscience community or medical community, we found that out through research that engaged or involved functional brain MRIs. And when pressure was applied to different parts of the body, I think it was specifically the initial studies, but basically the areas, they studied patients without fibromyalgia or so-called controls and people with fibromyalgia. The same areas of brain lit up in both controls and patients with fibromyalgia upon pressure on the thumb. But in women with fibromyalgia, the areas lit up at a lower pressure. So that's how we know that the pain is real, but it's also starting at levels that are not considered painful in people without pain. So that's kind of the summary of the early research. And we have had more research supporting this notion that central nervous system, aka our brain, is altered in humans with chronic pain. But the pain is real. It doesn't make the pain less real. The pain is real, but the issue is that the root cause of the pain in people with chronic pain is in the brain rather than in the body.
So it's very interesting. It's kind of almost like mind-blowing, because I cannot think of the number of patients, especially women, who would have had their symptoms completely invalidated, that you're making it up, it's in your head, it's not real, it's functional pain, or, you know, something like that. For my audience sake, who may not know the term fibromyalgia, can you kind of explain, well, how do you make the diagnosis of fibromyalgia?
Of course, and I probably should have explained that before I went into the deep dive. My apologies. So the simplest definition of fibromyalgia is that it means chronic pain in various areas of the body that span the whole body, both parts, above and below the waist, that is present for more than 3 months. And it's often accompanied, or these people have often other symptoms, including, they even call it brain fog or non-refreshing sleep. They feel like they were hit by a train when they wake up in the morning. They can have headaches, irritable bowel syndrome, bladder issues, basically all kinds, different kinds of chronic issues. So when you're a clinician, when you start hearing these symptoms, when people are describing their symptoms, the light usually comes off, like, oh, these are all symptoms that correspond to a term we call central sensitization. And that means that there is likely involvement of the central nervous system, which is turning the volume button on amplifying on multiple sensory inputs or multiple data from the nervous system, and it's amplifying it and it's augmenting it. And people often also report higher sensitivity to sounds, smells, cold air. Like you kind of get the sense of this person's clinical symptoms when you listen to them for a while.
It almost feels like people with fibromyalgia are almost like a live wire, and they probably react to any sort of environmental changes at a way lower threshold compared to a person who does not struggle with fibromyalgia.
That's exactly right. That's actually a very good comparison, live wire. I like that.
So, but what is triggering this? What is the common, like, you know, in medicine, we always talk about Occam's razor, a one unifying factor which covers everything. So what is the cause for this sort of lessened threshold?
Right. And I think that's what has led to so much suffering, in that people were looking just for that one thing that explains it all. And in a summary, you could say that this central sensitization is what causes all of this, or is the umbrelling term and reason for all of these symptoms, central sensitization, or the brain getting sensitized to sensory input from the body. And what is behind that? That's kind of the bigger can of worms, or the bigger topic. It's nuanced, it's granular. You can't like put it on a sticker, but basically I'm sure you have heard of this model, biopsychosocial model, when there is no one structural cause, but the bio part of the word biopsychosocial is there could have been prior injury, prior illness. There could be a family history, meaning some genetic components. So that's the biological part. But then the psychosocial means there is evidence to suggest that early childhood trauma, and when I say trauma, I don't mean just big T trauma, but any time the child was made feeling unsafe, that contributes to the initial onset or memory of the unsafe situations that is stored in our brain. And then with progressive more hits on the trauma part, so to speak, or during our lifetime, it starts creating this, it's part of the default mode network that connects amygdala and other brain centers that are older structures. And that contributes to this overall phenomenon that leads to the central sensitization. And then there is the social part, which is part of our upbringing, the society pressure, peer pressure, what messages we absorb as children, as we are growing up, what is normal, what is not normal. We absorb these truths as ultimate truths. We don't question them, but they also become part of our default mode network, the connection of neurons that determines how we view the world and our role in it. It's kind of very short summary, so to speak.
Very complicated. It sounds like, you know, it's not a simple diagnosis, but it's very complicated diagnosis. But I feel, you know, even during medical training or something like that, fibromyalgia is associated with a lot of stigma. It's a very stigmatized disease. And now with post-COVID, long COVID symptoms, are you seeing more patients with the diagnosis of fibromyalgia? And is it just different from post-COVID, long COVID?
So you packed several questions in one, but I appreciate how in tune you are with the topic, because you're absolutely right. The stigma is real. And it mostly comes, or it can be nailed or can be traced to the fact that when a physician doesn't find a structural cause, we cannot give a diagnosis. So we were blaming these women that the pain is in their head, and as if they did something wrong, right? As if they were the drug seekers. And many patients actually told me, as I was gathering their histories, they told me that I feel like a crazy person as I go to these doctors, because I tell them about my symptoms and they tell me I'm fine. And then they tell me that I'm a drug seeker or that I want drugs. It couldn't be farther from the truth. I don't want more drugs. I just want to feel better. And that's kind of a repetitive story. And that, as I said, it can be traced down to people, physicians didn't know how to talk to these patients because we couldn't find a structural cause. Now, the neuroplasticity research, the neuroscience, is actually 2 decades old. So it's not all new news. Like, it's not all new information, but people didn't know how to talk to these patients, and you have 15 minutes to talk to patients. So it all gets swept under the rug in a way and said, oh, would you like some psychotherapy or counseling, right? We don't actually explain it. And to answer the other question about long COVID and whether I see more patients. So I am now, how to say it, when it's, I have a selection bias, right? Because I own my own practice and I seek patients who have chronic pain. So of course I see more people with chronic pain, and it's due to the nature of my practice. But there is not conclusive evidence about long COVID in terms of whether it's all neuroplastic. There is some evidence to suggest that some patients actually do have immune system upregulation. So we can, from my perspective, what I understand about long COVID, we cannot sweep it all under the same umbrella of neuroplasticity, but there is a big component of it. And I would still separate fibromyalgia, if it's truly just pure fibromyalgia, it's separate from long COVID, because in fibromyalgia, generally, you do not have immune system activation. And in some patients with long COVID, you can identify some inflammatory process.
Interesting. So you use the term neuroplasticity. It's a very interesting term, right? I mean, it's a beautiful term. It's a beautiful phenomena. Can you dissect it for me? What is neuroplasticity?
Yeah, thank you so much. So the short summary is neuroplasticity is ability of our brain to change in response to experience. Ability of our brain to change in response to experience. And the way I explain it to my patients is that, remember when you were learning how to drive, at least when I was learning to drive stick shift, my entire body was like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? And I was feeling completely discombobulated. But with time, as I kept practicing, the neural pathways were cemented, right? And now I drive and I don't think anymore. And the same way how we, so any new skill that we learn, it takes our brain, our nervous system, some time to master it. But once it's mastered, it is automated, so to speak. It's an autopilot. Well, the same thing happens with chronic pain from fibromyalgia, even though it's less, like, we didn't give our brain permission to do it, but it did it anyway because it was practicing, creating, and responding to pain, and it created these highways, these neural pathways that lead to pain. And because we didn't know what to do with it, and we reacted with fear, it was just enforcing these neural pathways. But there is good news. There is good. So basically, it's a learned way for brain to perform a skill, and it has become really good at producing pain. The good news is, because I'm sure your next question might be like, is there any good news, right? And the good news is that this and the reason I'm so excited about talking about chronic pain is because this neuroscience research has shown that our brain is not finite, meaning our brain's ability to learn is not finite. It learns until the moment we die. And the neuroscientists, the big names of people who have studied chronic pain is Thorweger, for example, one of the big names. Another is Dr. Dan Claw. He's actually a rheumatologist and anesthesiologist. And they were able to confirm that when the brain is able to feel safe, when the nervous system is able to feel safe, it will start rewiring these pain pathways. It will start redirecting them, and pain can be reduced. The most famous study that is cited the most in the last 2 years is called so-called Boulder back pain study, when they had 150 participants, 50 had a regular, these were people with back pain. So it's not typical fibromyalgia patients, but what the common core or the common denominator with fibromyalgia is that all of these 150 patients were identified as having non-structural back pain. So that's important piece, because patients pain in fibromyalgia is non-structural. So they were put in three arms. One was control, one was sham injections, and one was this pain reprocessing therapy, this new way of training your nervous system to feel safe. And the most fascinating result was that 93% patients had improvement, and 60% of them had resolution of pain. So none of previous studies were able ever to show that much improvement in chronic pain.
And that was in the
pain reprocessing therapy. So the pain reprocessing therapy consisted of 2 sessions per week times 4 weeks. So total of 8 sessions with a skilled therapist, or in their cases, it was a therapist. But the bottom line was training the patients, or explaining to them and having them do it, how to talk differently to their nervous system that was pertaining to their pain. So they were reframing the meaning of the pain. And then through graded exposure, because many of these people were afraid to move, the movement was, or sit for too long, they were training them or showing them how to face the pain without the underlying fear or beliefs that the pain means something bad. Because the wired response of our human psyche is that pain equals bad. And what we talked about at the beginning, that the regular pain, that's an adaptive response, and usually does mean danger. When we burn ourselves, we pull the hand away because to protect ourselves. That's the nervous system protecting us. In chronic pain, it's not the same. So, but our brain didn't catch up to that. So they were teaching them, showing them how to rethink the concept of pain. And then they show that these results actually are holding 1 year later, which is also, to me, a fascinating and mind-blowing result, right? And these studies, those results were not published yet, but they will be published soon.
That's actually, I mean, that's pretty amazing. 8 sessions, that is literally in 8 sessions, if you take a person who is crippled with the fear of pain, not moving, and probably on a bunch of opioids and narcotic type medications. And for them to feel safe and to be pain-free for 1 year, that's an amazing feat. I mean, it's mammoth. It's big. I can't wait for the studies to come out and, you know, it's going to be a big, big splash.
So I have to admit, and I have to self-correct myself, the people who had the low back pain, they were less, like the pain on that label, the severity of pain on average was between 4 and 5 out of 10. So you could, that was one of the criticism of the study, that it was less severe pain than a regular population. It was like a selected group of people. And we don't actually, I'm not privy to all the information about their narcotics, but, and I'm not allowed to, there is a study coming out, results soon, in the next few months, in the next very few short months, when they did more extensive study. And
so, but now, you know, let me ask you, these patients, you know, they are, it's a tough population, because I think the doctor-patient trust is kind of very fractured in this group, right? Because every doctor is like, oh, it's in your head, it's in your head. There's nothing wrong with you. You're absolutely perfect. Your tests are all normal. I'm not sure I can help you. And they kind of pass you on from doctor to doctor to doctor. Maybe because they don't know what to do with them. And eventually, I'm sure most of your patients search for you, research for you, and come to you. How do you treat them? What is your approach with these patients?
So thank you again for the question and for your compassion. It clearly shows that you have very good overview and understanding of the land, so to speak, because you know what it means. Like you encounter these patients, you know what they are going through. So one of the biggest mistakes nocebo effects we have as clinicians is when we don't spend the time, which is almost direct result of current insurance driven system. You have 15 minutes for the patient and they have 15 problems, and it's hard to direct the traffic of information and provide what they need. What these people need in the first place is validation and acknowledgement that the pain is real. Many patients start crying after even I just started explaining, like, listen, we know that your pain is real and you did nothing wrong. So validation, explaining the neuroplasticity. And then some patients, I have had few who had improvement in their pain just by learning that their brain can produce pain. That's the most rewarding. And I don't want to say the easiest, but it's almost the simplest when their nervous system can recover just from learning, oh my gosh, okay, this makes sense. Then the second portion, our second group of patients is we go over I explain the process of neuroplasticity. And then we talk about how our beliefs can trigger pain through chronic stress, like basically presenting danger signal to the nervous system, which then triggers the alarm system or this flight or fight response. And I always will remember one patient who, I examined her, she had features suggestive of fibromyalgia, and we talked about it. And then she came back 3 months later only to tell me that she didn't really need to see me for a follow-up, but she's coming back because she wanted to thank me. After she processed the information, it took her some while, but then she started questioning, is it possible that the way I'm thinking about this stressful situation with my son is contributing? And she said, as soon as she realized that the way she was just hanging on and being very stressed over the custody situation of her son, I mean, of her grandchild, it was her son's child, she said the pain started improving, like dissipating at the time. So it's beautiful to hear, but it's also evidence. It's evidence that this works. And we didn't use any extra medications. All we did was you still need to do the physical and exam, right? Like you need to listen to the patient, examine them, rule out a structural cause. And then the important part is to explain to them, what does it mean? What does neuroplasticity mean? And what can you do? And the main thing, so it's, I would say it's three parts. Number one, still do the structural part, meaning either document what is there structurally or rule it out. Number two, explain to the validate them and explain what it means to the neuroplasticity. And then number three, talk to them about the ways how to soothe the nervous system or how to make the nervous system feel safe. That's kind of the short summary of my approach.
That's fabulous. I mean, you know, I think one of the reasons maybe I'm a little bit more in tune is I have a lot of patients who kind of seek me out where they feel like they were told everything is okay. And, you know, it's both men and women. And they're like, something is wrong. I know something is wrong. Can you help me? And some of them may not even have cardiac issues. And I'm like, okay, let's go head to toe. What is this? This is this. And I'm like, I don't think I can help you, but maybe let's go to a rheumatologist or maybe let's go to a neuropsych or something like that. So it's a lot of patients who are not heard and they want to be heard. And they, as you said, self-select and find their way in different aspects.
I want to tell you, though, I wanna change a little bit your wording, because you said that you tell them, I can't help you. But what you just did, you listen to them, you examine them, and you tell them they don't seem to have a structural heart disease. That's actually a huge burden off their mind. So I have stopped saying that, like, I cannot, because any encounter that they have with the clinician, cardiologist, whether it's cardiologist or rheumatologist, that feels validating and gives them clarity is actually helpful.
You're right. I was going back to what I said. I said, okay, I don't find blockages. I don't see anything which is going to immediately kill you or put you in danger of dying. We have ruled that out, but we still haven't figured out this puzzle, okay? And I kind of come clean, and I think it might be beyond my scope right now. And I have to send you to someone who may have more knowledge about what you're going through than I can. But the reassurance, this is not life-threatening or something like that. You know, yes, structural. Now, you know, there's always this buzz of gut health and mind health and mindfulness, gut health, heart health, all are connected. Is there a correlation between microbiome, gut microbiome, and fibromyalgia and pain threshold?
So it's funny that you ask about it, because Dr. Dan Claw had done a study that limited calorie intake in people with chronic pain, and it showed improvement. Now, this was a small study, and I don't think it's widely propagated in terms of limiting calorie intake would be the way to go. I never talk to patients about food or nutrition in that way, but it's possible that one of the mechanisms is microbiome. I have to admit, I don't have right now from the top of my head any information putting together microbiome and resolution of pain. But when you think about it intuitively, if microbiome disruption results in increased inflammation, like those micro-inflammation or leaky gut, can it lead to increased pain through the sensory input from our body to the nervous system? And I think it's entirely possible. But what I focus on when I talk to patients is trying not, if I truly diagnose them with fibromyalgia and they don't have a overt weight problem, or they, like, I try not to focus on changing their eating habits or lifestyle habit first. I always try to bring it to safety of the nervous system. The lifestyle changes in lifestyle usually follow, but to bring them on board and buy in, so to speak, the concept that neuroplasticity and nervous system safety is what is important. That's what I focus on, because it has been shown in these studies that that's the most important part, to have patients accept the concept of neuroplasticity and then believe, have confidence in their ability to change it.
It's interesting. When you talk about, you know, the safety and the neuroplasticity, is there like a physical therapy protocol? Is there some type of movement that you encourage them to pursue, swimming or just greater exercising? How does that look like?
There is no one-fit-all approach. I do refer patients, or I prefer to refer patients to physical therapists that have experience with patients with chronic pain, because they are kind of the guides, the bridges, so to speak, that allow them, that enable them to show them that you can do this safely, and deciding which pain is acceptable. Some patients have this, they come and tell me, well, I went for a walk and then I had to lay down for an hour or two or three. And I try to zone or hone in on the question, well, why did you lay down? Did you lay down because you were freaking out because you went for a walk for 10 minutes? Were you hurting? Or did you do it out of love and respect for your body, like you felt that you needed to rest and you were feeling good about it? Because that is what determines the nervous system safety. And skilled physical therapists have that ability to allow for or teach them what is, how to recognize what is safe, right? If there is, I was able to identify, okay, if there is no structural damage or there is only mild knee osteoarthritis, you can safely walk. Then the patient will feel better about kind of pushing themselves a little bit. And it's about small steps, so not overdoing it. There is a famous passage in the book by Dan Gordon, the person who, I'm sorry, Alan Gordon, the person who wrote the book Way Out. He describes how he, when he was already working with his back pain, he was already better. But then he needed to drive for several hours and his back was hurting. And he said, no, I got it. I know neuroplasticity. This is just my brain. I'm going to go through it. And he drove like for 5 hours straight. And he said when he got out of the car, he almost like basically fainted from the pain. That doesn't serve anyone. So when you have severe pain, do whatever you need to do to comfort your body. But there is quite a range before you get to that point. So explore that, you know, the level from 0 to 6, for example. What can you do in that interval? When it's above 6, we'll talk about other means to control your pain, whatever you need to do in the moment. But between 0 and 6, that's quite a big interval for you to work with your body. Yeah.
So how does mindfulness come in? Does any of the breathing techniques and the mindfulness practice techniques, does that help through self-soothe?
Thank you for the question. I probably should have mentioned it sooner. So the term somatic tracking refers to this mindfulness practice when, and it was coined by Alan Gordon. It refers to focusing on pain on purpose without judgment. And I have patients, I go over the practice with them and I ask them however many seconds or minutes you can do every day, or whenever you feel like you can do it, maybe not driving, but basically, ideally, you have the pain while you're doing it. And some patients have pain while seated, so we do it seated. And focus on the pain on purpose, describe it to yourself. And when we do it the first time, they describe the pain to me aloud, so they use words. I'm like, okay, is that all? And before we do that, I have them slow the breathing, so deepen the breath, which automatically slows down your heart rate, as you know, and also basically gives a signal to the nervous system, I'm safe. And then we actually say these words. After they describe the pain to me, I lead them, I say the words, which can be changed anytime to what fits them, but it's something, it goes something like this. Dear brain, I know that the pain you're sending me is just a message of a threat, of a danger signal. And I want you to know that I'm safe. In the moment, I'm safe. You can send all the signals down my way if you want to, but I'm safe. This is going to be past. It's going to be over and I'm going to be okay. But if you want, you could start cutting down on the signals of threat because I am safe. We repeat it's almost like a mantra. I am safe. This will pass. I will be okay. And I have had some amazing experiences when the patients reported that the pain either resolved or traveled to another body part. And I'm like, isn't that interesting? And this is how we start collecting the evidence sheet. When patients see, like, we just did it. So they have it in front of them. They just experienced it and they can write down, I did nothing else, just spoke those words and the pain went from right knee to the right ankle. Why would it be? And there is no inflammation because I just examined them, right? So we then work on this evidence sheet and they start adding basically when was the pain inconsistent, and that's how they can tell brain, I'm on to you. I know what you're doing. I know it may sound silly when I'm talking about it like that. Like, is she?
No, I actually, it's beautiful, right? In a way, your brain is fooling you, or, you know, trying to make you believe something which is not there. There's no inflammation, but you're acting like there's an inflammation in my knee. So it's okay. I know what you're trying to tell me, but I'm okay. So calm down. It's almost like a telling your right brain to listen to your left side, or your left brain to your right side. It's like, I got this. I got this. I know.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. The brain is fooling us. There is a term called predictive processing, and there are multiple videos on it, but you may have heard, if you haven't, I will send you a link to a rubber band experiment. When they have a person, they put their arms in the, like they, it's at a desk. They, both their arms are on the table, and they put, and then they, so they have a rubber band pretending that it's their left arm, and their right, their own arm is right next to it, but there is a screen. They don't see their left arm. They only see this rubber band. And he does an experiment where it does starts like pinching it. And the brain responds with pain when they pinch the left arm. It's just mind blowing. But this is called predictive processing. The brain got confused, right? Because this is how you have the arms in front of you. So fire. And they're like, oh my gosh, I'm burning. And then he grabs a hammer and they scream in pain. They have real pain. So because the brain predicts that it's supposed to hurt. It's supposed to hurt. So it's a smoke without a fire. The brain produces symptoms without actual damage.
So there's a movie, I'm blanking on the name of the movie. These two girls, teenage girls, climb this tallest tower, abandoned tower in the middle of Texas. Okay, it's like literally it's an abandoned cell phone tower. It's super tall, and no one should be climbing that tower. It's rusty, and as these two girls are climbing, things are falling down, and they're showing the whole height. I'm telling you, watching that, I could feel like my toes were tingling, and like as if I'm dropping. And I was like, oh my God, this is so bearded. I'm all cringy. And my daughter, I just turn around and look at her. She's feeling the same thing too. We are feeling the pain of the person watching it. And imagine if that's happening to yourself without watching any of that. When there is no fire, but your brain believes there is fire. Like, you know, you have to retrain it.
So the last thing I was going to mention about that is, many patients, I had one patient just recently, I was explaining it to him, and he said, and I'm like, does it make you feel better knowing that your brain is producing these symptoms? And he's like, no, I'm actually mad, angry. Like, what, how dare you do that, right? Like, why are you doing this to me? I already have enough problems. Why are you? And so the last piece of it is, have compassion for your own brain. Your brain, so many people respond to pretending or imagining brain as a scared child. Basically, it's a wired, it behaves as a wired organ. Like, it's wired to respond to threats. A little child or a little dog, a baby, puppy, they're afraid of rain. You would not tell them, how dare you cry or whimper. You would tell them, you would like hug them and say, it's going to be okay. And that's basically what it comes down to, treating your brain as a scared child or puppy who is completely out of regulation, is outregulated because it doesn't know how to do it. And we have to parent that little brain or that little scared brain. And that usually helps people understand. I mean, it's not overnight, right? That patient, it took him a couple of weeks to forgive his brain, so to speak, to accept that the brain is like a creature that he has to speak with gently, like a child, because in a way our older brain, the older structures, the corpus callosum and what is encompassed, is an older brain. Like, it's not advanced as our prefrontal cortex. So I just wanted to add it at the end.
Oh, that's beautiful. That was really, really beautiful. Dr. Z, I think I had such a wonderful, such an enlightening conversation here. It's there's so much compassion in what you do, and kudos, the amount of patience and grace and courage, and you need to do work like what you're doing is fantastic. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. And likewise, you do important work being cardiologists and doing holistic kind of health and talking to patients about important things. So likewise, but thank you for acknowledging.
Yes. Okay. Now let's get into like a rapid fire kind of a thing. True or false? Okay. You feel free to give me a one sentence explanation, but we are going to move through 10 different topics. Ready? Fibromyalgia only affects women.
Yes.
Weather changes can trigger fibromyalgia flares.
Yes and no. So not weather itself, but the sensory input the brain receives when it detects like the proprioception and unconscious signals can give the brain signal of threat, and that can lead to it, but not directly weather changes or pressure changes, not themselves, but the brain reaction to them. Yes.
Yes. That's a good one. That's actually very interesting. Now, you need expensive functional MRIs and other scans to diagnose fibromyalgia.
False, of course. You need a good clinician who listens to you, examines you, and gives you explanation of what's going on.
You need a real doctor, a real medicine person who can understand the workings of the human body and who's compassionate.
And I would especially say here, you do not need expensive multi-function, testing allergy or sensitivity to multiple. You can do it later if you are really interested whether you are allergic to something, but you don't need that for diagnosis of a chronic pain condition.
So you're going to love this one. I can take a whole bunch of supplements, drink green juice and different powders, and can cure my fibromyalgia.
Maybe, but it's not required. Like, good for you if you feel that, or if you have found help with supplements, but the whole point of addressing fibromyalgia with pain reprocessing therapy or the mind-body approach is to step away from telling you that there is something wrong and that you need more of something. I'm all for supplements and multivitamin and vitamin D. And if there is there are certain deficiencies, like many women are deficient in vitamin D, including myself. So I absolutely believe in evidence-based supplementation. But beyond that, I do think that what we need more is understanding and working with our nervous system rather than and having a varied vegetable-rich diet, whole foods or real food diet, rather than ton of supplements. And I don't forget what else you meant. Oh, the green juices. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I'm a very supplement, as you said, evidence-based supplementation, vitamin D, B12. If you have specific iron deficiencies, all of those can trigger, but I don't believe in a whole bunch of, supplements, which is going to make my mitochondria work better and this and that. I don't know, man. Give me a study which shows that it does. A study which is not sponsored by the supplement company. Then I will, How about changing my question here? What is the role of red light therapy and cryotherapy in the management of chronic pain?
So I'm not aware of studies from the top of my head about either of them. You can send me some links if you are aware.
Honestly, I have not. I mean, red light therapy, so-called chronic inflammation, etc. But again, this kind of falls to the same supplement region. And again, for cryotherapy, instant muscle recovery after injury or something, people have showed that, but not like whole body. I don't think the science is there enough.
I was afraid that I missed some information, that I missed some memo. I was gonna say that BioLamp, I have heard there was time when they were promoting BioLamps for mood improvement. And I was gonna say, I had a colleague who was swearing by it. And to me, it's such a inexpensive and safe investment. Like, I'm not gonna tell a patient no, but I also want to try to uncouple the feeling they have to have it in order to get better. You can get it if you truly feel it's helping you and it's aligned with what you believe in, but you don't have to get it in order to feel better.
That's such a true statement, right? Sometimes, like, I feel we are such sitting in a world of influencers and so-called billionaires who are believing or selling longevity, which is basically prevention in a new bottle of longevity, etc. And they are like, oh, you need this supplement, you need this supplement, you need blah, 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 blah. And then later on, you'll find out in the thing that they are sponsored by this company, etc. I mean, there was a time they blamed us doctors for doing it, but now people, they don't have a medical degree. They have no validity. They are touting stuff and the world seems to believe it and buy it.
Why do you think people believe them? Tell me, what is your opinion? I know it doesn't fall into this podcast.
Yeah, but I think it's desperation. It's and everybody wants that millionaire or billionaire's lifestyle. And they feel like, you know, like, why do you want a Gucci bag or a Prada or something, even though you can't afford it? You just want to belong in that club, I think. And you feel, I mean, that's my theory, that you just want to be like, oh, I'm like, I'm exclusive. I take the same supplement as X person and this, I mean, you know, ABC person. And, you know, I think it gives them a sense of belonging, which, you know, to each their own. And as long as it's not causing any major life-altering issues, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect the big population standpoint. But it's ridiculous and it's stupid, and we should be making more people exercise more, do more mindfulness work and things like that, which actually has valid science backing it and all these random things. I think this is going to be my favorite question. Chocolate cures fibromyalgia.
Oh, I wish. But listen, this goes to the belief, right? So if we decide that chocolate is my placebo, I say go for it, but with moderation, right? So there is no currently available evidence to support this claim. But what I tell patients, if you truly believe that you need a little bit piece of chocolate every day, I have a patient who has one piece of chocolate, dark chocolate every night, and she feels this is what she needs before she goes to, like, you know, this is her nightcap.
Yes. I mean, you know, chocolate, one piece of dark chocolate is better than smoking a joint or a glass of wine or any other self-soothers we have. So, you know, she should go.
So the answer would be, I wish, but not as of yet confirmed.
Well, thank you so much for playing along with this. What an incredible episode, Dr. Z. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your science. And, you know, truly you showed us what a great human being you are. And to our listeners, if you found value in today's conversation, please subscribe, leave a review, share this episode with someone who might need to hear this. Remember, understanding your pain is the first step to transformation. So until next time, this is Dr. Arati Maran reminding you that your best reboot might just be a mindset shift away. Stay curious and stay hopeful and keep rebooting. Thank you so much.